On February the 6th, 1998, in Chicago, Illinois, Imam W. Dean Muhammad granted the following interview to U.S. News and World Report.
Well, I'm very flattered, and I...
For a long time. I got off for a while, but I got back on.
Well, you've probably been reading it longer than I have.
I've only
been working there for a few months. I've been writing pieces from India.
And then you're young. That's 30 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my editors will be very happy to hear that.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Well, what I'm trying to do, and I hope it will be a successful endeavor, is to present a much more balanced view of Islam in America than the media generally tends to portray.
We were told, and I'm eager to contribute in any way I possibly can.
Great. Well, first off, why don't you just tell me a little bit about what Islam means to you, and what you feel Islam... what the future of Islam in America is.
Yes. But when I think of Islam, really now, presently, I think of Islam as the hope, our hope, as Muslims, for having a serious problem moved out of the way. Problems that I experienced as a young man, and I would say a distorted form of religion. I won't say Islam, but a distorted form of religion. And as a follower of my father, Elijah Muhammad, you know, he passed in 1975. But I used to think that we were really the people, African Americans or blacks, who were kind of separated from everybody else. But as I got to know my Christian neighbors, especially leaders, political leaders, and church leaders, I started to see that we're not the only ones, that many African-American Christians or black Christians also have a problem having faith in the future of blacks and whites living and working together for a better world. And Islam, it has been Islam that has convinced me that if we follow the principles of the prophets of God, for us it's Muhammad, prayers and peace be upon him. For the Christians it's Jesus Christ, peace be upon him. If we follow the best of the guidance that we receive by way of prophets from God, we can have a good world. We can have a good world, a world that welcomes all of us at the table of the graces that God created for us.
Inshallah.
Yeah. And I believe that's what all communities want. All communities want the same. They just want to have respect and be included in at the world table of the graces of God.
Now, I've heard a lot of different estimates of the numbers of groups and individuals affiliated with your movement. What kind of numbers are out there? I've heard everything from 200,000 to 2 million.
Yes. It's my belief that perhaps active, you know, the Christian membership is in the great majority in this country. But most of the Christians that are attracted to Islam are not church-going Christians. Very few of them are church-going Christians. So we have many Christians, millions of Christians in the Christian society that are not in touch with Christianity, except as a name, but not a way of life. And they follow habits. They follow by habits. What is American, not what is Christian. And we have many Muslims now who are no different. They are Muslims by name, and they follow by habit what is Muslim. As-salamu alaykum, wa alaykum as-salam, you know. And maybe occasionally they'll attend an Eid gathering, a holiday gathering or something. But they're just in the American society. They're just in the American society, that's all. But if you ask them, say, are you a Muslim? Well, yes, I'm a Muslim. Who you identify with? Imam Dabi Muhammad, the Nation of Islam, one or the other. And it's my belief, from not just guessing without something to support my conclusion, but I study the conversion records till now, almost till now. Well, I won't say till now. Last time I did rock since till 92, and I also I'm influenced by the number of people that I meet in the course of a day. Traveling, I travel a lot. I travel more than I stay put. Who tell me that they are Muslim and they identify with me. They see me and greet me on the street and pick me up. So I believe that there is close to 2 million African-American Muslims by name, not necessarily by practice, African-American Muslims. And I do believe that there is close to 500,000 of African-American Muslims who are practicing Muslims. Yeah, practicing Muslim, as much as any other Muslim public is practicing Muslim. You understand where I'm coming from?
Sure.
And you won't see all these people come to one place. Never will all the people belong to a religion come to one scene or one place, you know. And I have purposely, I've done it purposely, I've purposely told my audiences that it's not important that you come to a physical facility to identify with Islam or with Muslims. I said, well, it's important that you stay in touch with the revelation, the scripture that God gave us through Muhammad, the prophet. That's the Quran. That you stay in touch with that book, and you stay in touch with the reality, the real life of the man who received that book about 14 centuries ago, Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, you know. So that's what I stress. And I say, it's not even that important that you, when you attend one of these facilities, come to one of these facilities, that you come to an African-American facility. I say, every mosque is a mosque of a Muslim. They may be more convenient for you. Maybe you even feel more comfortable in a mosque that's not African-American. And that's true. I just attended a meeting here downtown in Chicago.
You were there?
Yeah. And I was there as their guest to lead the Jumu'ah, the prayers, you know. But really, I was feeling the Brotherhood of Islam, and with the different nationalities represented there, you know, downtown is a situation for that, you know. And it was very, very comforting for me to be in service with so many different nationalities. So really, I prefer that kind of environment myself. My spirit prefers that kind of environment to one that's all black or all white or all red or all whatever, you know. I think that's Islam and that's humanity. That's the human spirit. True human spirit.
Now, but how many of the, say, the 2 million African-American Muslims or of the larger Muslim community in America, what kind of numbers are there about how many of them are affiliated with your organization?
Well, I'm affiliated. I would think that that figure I gave you, about a 500,000, would be affiliated, and among them would be some non-African Americans, but a very small percentage. I would think maybe 2.5 to a maximum 5% who are not African American, or black, who are not black. So, but I have tried to present myself publicly as a person who's interested in all Muslims' condition, our condition, and us following the right direction in the path of God. I've indicated that very strongly to all Muslims. And so as a result of that, many immigrant Muslims identify with my leadership, though they're not affiliated with the mosque in my leadership.
Yes, I was surprised to see that at the downtown masjid there were very large numbers of non-African Americans. Yeah. Possibly more non-African Americans than African Americans.
So, yeah.
I think a testament to that you're not just talking the talk but walking the walk.
That's right.
You've been quoted often as saying just how Islam can fit into the American system of values.
Yes.
At the beautiful masjid in D.C., Imam Yusuf, he was actually the one who suggested that I come and talk to you. Several of the people there said that you had spoken about how the Declaration of Independence could be almost an Islamic document.
That's right.
Can you?
It's in the spirit, same spirit as Islam, for mankind, for the destiny of mankind as a human group destined to meet with the will of God, or to agree in the will of God. And the will of God is not for God says that He looks not to our faces. He looks to our hearts, you know, not to our faces, for the faces. The face of a rich man, or a poor man, or a white man, or a black man, God is not looking to that. He's looking at our hearts, our intentions, our good intentions. And I believe that the future for us as citizens of this country and people who support the Constitution of these United States, I believe that the future intended for us by the founding fathers, intended for us as a society, by the founding fathers, is very close, almost the same as the future intended by God for us as followers of the Scripture, our Constitution, the Quran, for our spiritual life and for our community life. And so I see the compatibility. I see a compatibility for the spirit and the language, not just the language, or just the spirit, but the spirit and the language. The spirit of the Constitution is that we live with respect for the common life of people, the first life of people, and the first life of people is human life. So we are to unite together as equals upon the recognition that we all are human beings. And that's what God wants, the same thing. Put it in different lengths, a little slightly different length, but it's exactly the same thing. That God has created us human beings in the mold that He Himself prepared for us. And that is to worship God. Don't just go your own way, but worship God. Recognize that there's an authority bigger than man. Worship God. But go for the best that you have in your creation. Yes. For your destiny as a human person. And that, to me, that's, again, the vision of the founding fathers and the vision that we have in Islam.
At the masjid, several people told me that you had preached that even the language of the documents could well be Islamic, that talk of endowed by the Creator with inalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness.
Yes.
You see? That's, that could have come from the mouths of either Islamic teachers or either
or from a politician who stands upon the framework of the Constitution of the United States. Yeah, it could come from either. I find great satisfaction in recognizing that the language of our Constitution puts God above man, and puts man on common grounds in terms of what he can contribute to the world. And it was inevitable that American society recognized minorities, African Americans, as equal citizens, and accord equal rights and opportunities to all of us in this country, to every human being in this great society we call it American society. It was inevitable because the founding fathers set the framework for it and gave the spirit, and it had to come about.
Mm-hmm. Now, people often speak about Judeo-Christian values in America, but I have often wondered just what are these Judeo-Christian values that would not also be Islamic values?
Not many.
Yeah.
Very much the same.
Can you think of any qualities that Judaism and Christianity may have in common that would not also be shared by Islam?
I don't know any worth mentioning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems
that we would also share. Uh-huh. Yes, that's mm-hmm. true. One problem for mm-hmm. us is, and I don't know if this is Christianity mm-hmm. or American secular society, mm-hmm. I wouldn't say this is so much Christianity. And that is the belief that people are to be free with no, I would say, environment or with no framework for that freedom. Freedom with no framework, freedom with no environment, you know. Where are we to be free? You're not supposed to be free in the washroom. You're supposed to get in there and do what you have to do and get out of there. Freedom is in the society of men, of civilized people. You know, so we have the same idea of freedom that this nation had in the beginning of its experiment with freedom. And freedom meant freedom to pursue human excellence, and especially intellectual excellence, you know. That's a freedom then. That was the freedom. The most precious part of the human being, except for the heart, and the heart is only good if it's working with the brain, is the intellect of man. And we believe in Islam that God created man as an intellect, to be an intellect. And it is because of him functioning as an intellect that he is able to make the progress and reach the great objectives that God set for him, you know, set forth for him. And that if the intellect is not developed, education doesn't lead to society, then the society will fail to reach the destiny that God wants for us. We won't get that destination. So we see the intellect as being very important. So when we think of freedom, first thing we think of is freedom of the intellect. And I believe this was the idea in Christianity, in Christian society, where that freedom means the freedom of our intellect. And I make a little joke, you know, I say, freedom, I say, listen to it, it says free dome. I said, so where's the dome? This is the dome. I would say that we share the same respect and appreciation for freedom with Christians, in that we both see the intellect and, I would say, a higher education, quality education, as the I would say the forerunner of civilization. You know, as much as we agree there, then we share that same value, freedom as a value. You know, but all the other values we're the same. I tell Muslims, I say, you know, we don't drink alcohol, we tend to think that Christians are all drunkards, are all drinkers. I say the more conscious Christians see alcohol as a sin and an evil on society, even though they may take a drink in moderation. But they know that drinking is a sin. And we're told by our prophet, the prophet said, in alcohol is benefits and harm. He said, in alcohol, both benefits and harm. He said, but the harm outweighs the benefits. Therefore, it should be haram, forbidden. It should be forbidden, you know. So I told them that when Christians look at the harm and benefits of alcohol, they too take our position, same position, we take the same position, that we have to do control the amount of liquor and addiction to alcohol in society. Came through a community, I think it was a Holland Dutch community, and they had no liquor stores there. So I told them, I say, there were Christians who were already taking the lead. All thing we have to do is get on board. I say, they have neighborhood, liquor-free neighborhoods, Christians, in this country.
That's quite true. Now, what aspects of the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad have you kept, and which ones have you moved away from? I mean, your record is out there for people to see, but just to encapsulate it for my readers who are unfamiliar with the sweeping changes that you've made.
Yes. Well, I don't have time to explain. You don't have time for me to explain all this.
I'm going to quickly
hit some points.
Right.
The most important thing, and it seems like it's a contradiction, but it's not, is faith in God. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad didn't give us a religion in a straight way. He taught us something that was impossible for us, very ridiculous, that man, black man, was God. But he did tell us that God, whether it's the black man or whatever, God is God. God is the supreme. God is over everything, and we need God. We have to depend on God. We should pray to God. So he did give us a sense of faith, experience of faith, and we have retained that. We couldn't leave God. I considered going to communism in my life as a young man. Yeah, because what I was taught was that was bothering my head too much. Mm-hmm. When I read some of the communist beliefs, it appealed to my good senses, my rational senses, more than what I was getting from my father. So I was considering examining communism and maybe thinking about it. I was thinking maybe even that the teachers of my father recognized socialism. Because the little pamphlet we got from his teacher's name is Fry, not an American, he came from outside. And it says, what is social? It says, social is the advocate of society of men, a group of men for one common cause. And equality means to be equal in everything. Now, I couldn't buy that either. How are you going to be equal in everything? God has made us equal and unequal. We can't be equal in everything. Somebody's going to be superior to another, you know. So I was just bothered. What I'm saying is I was just bothered. Nothing was satisfying my mind. And I came to the conclusion that the best society for us is society of Islam.
But
as seen in the Quran and in the life of Muhammad the Prophet.
But could you just review very briefly the most important things that you kept and most important things you...
Faith, number one. Mm-hmm. Faith, number one. Mm-hmm. We remain as people believe in God, that there's a superior over us, that we are dependent upon superior, that is God. Mm-hmm. So I kept that. But I also kept, I would say, a desire to see African-American people with a better life on this earth. And all people too, but I felt a personal, I would say, a kind of a personal responsibility to serve the improvement of African-American life in community. Not necessarily individual life. There are some Christians, they have beautiful, African-American blacks, they have beautiful lives. They have beautiful individual life, beautiful family life. And there are some wealthy African Americans, they're doing very well. They have their life, it's good. But when I look at the neighborhoods and the community of African Americans, I still see that there is a great need for change. Something has to happen to change the way we look at our responsibility in community. So I kept that. I also kept the sense of government. I believe that the Nation of Islam trained us to be militant, but not militant to go to Africa, not even to separate from the U.S. and demand some separate states, as Elijah Muhammad was saying in the 60s. Most important for us was to appreciate government in our lives and to live with a sense of government and to have that government in my personal life, have that government in my family life, and to try as much as possible to awaken a sense of government in my neighbor's life so that the neighbors have a sense of government, appreciation for government. So I've become almost a fanatical supporter of the United States government. It is because Elijah Muhammad and his teachings made me appreciate a sense of government, the value of government. I value government in the lives of people. And I think God intended for us to have government in our lives. So that's the main thing. Mm-hmm. The rest of it is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I don't know why.
What specific things have you moved away from? The theory of Yaqub?
Yes. What I've moved away from is the attempt of my father's teacher to give us what I would call is myth of creation. A myth of creation. And that's what we all have. We all got myths of creation. Yeah. So I've studied, looked, or I've read books on Oriental theology, Oriental myths, by me, Oriental myths, African myths, and that's what we all were given myths. So for us, says, well, here people have been cut off from their myths. They're in America and they're lost. They've been cut off from their myths. So let me give them a myth. So he gave us the myth of creation. That flattered the ego of the black man, you know. And that, to me, as something that will keep us confused and deny us opportunities to grow and prosper in the world of truth, in the world of reality, you know. So I don't buy it anymore. I see that myth. I get benefits from it. I get intellectual benefits from it, from the study of it. I think the man was kind of a genius. He put together a powerful myth. And now that I know where he got the pieces from, you know, he was like Frankenstein, Dr. Mm-hmm. Frankenstein. He picked up some dead pieces here and dead pieces there, and he put them all together, and then he breathed life into the creature that he was making.
You mean the Honorable Elijah Muhammad or Farid Muhammad?
Farid Muhammad.
Farid Muhammad.
Yeah, the Elijah Muhammad didn't have, he didn't have a circumstance in his life to make him think that way.
Yes, it's always seemed amazing to me that Farid Muhammad, a man whose backgrounds are mysterious. So you
mysterious, you're right.
Yes, you've noted that you believe he came from India rather than from Mecca.
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I believe he came from the area where Ahmadis are, mm-hmm. where the founder of Ahmadiyyism was, mm-hmm. the area of Qadiani people. Mm-hmm. Lahore, Pakistan, and that area, right.
That's where I was living here until very recently.
Yeah, I believe he came from that area, and I believe that he also was influenced by the many religions of India, not just the teachings of Ahmadis, but the many religions of India. I think he was influenced by those many religions to formulate for us a temporary religion. And I say that because I'm convinced that he meant it to be a temporary religion for us. He meant for us to one day come into Islam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, perhaps the major point of divergence with the old Nation of Islam philosophy and the doctrine that you now preach is that in Orthodox Sunni Islam, of course, the belief that Muhammad, peace be upon him, is the last in the seal of the prophets,
yes.
And that there is no God but God.
Yes.
Just to recap, what mm-hmm. I'm sure is old for you, but for my readers, just to yes. recap, you've moved away from and renounced the belief that Farid Muhammad is associated with the divinity, and that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was a prophet.
That's right, exactly. Mm-hmm. We have come to know that Farah, my father's trainer, our teacher, wanted to put something together, formulate an idea, a way of life, a religion, concept of religion for us that would be welcomed by us, that would quickly be accepted by us. So what he did, he created something that would appeal to our nature, feel good as black and good, even superior, something to inflate our egos, you know. And he also recognized that blacks, even blacks that dislike whites, thought they would never be able to live in peace or have a good life with whites, living with whites, those blacks, many of them were Christians in their hearts, if not Christians in their practices, and many of them Christians in their practices. So what he tried to do is introduce something similar to Christianity. So Christianity, blacks already believed that a man was God, called Jesus. A picture given to us of Jesus Christ as a white man, or a Jew. And blacks were already believing that God is a man image. You know, that was nothing new. So Farad saw that he can get us quicker to come over to him if he presents what we're already accustomed to. So he gave us religion that was really not Christianity. Really, it's just as ridiculous for Christians as it is for Muslims, what he gave us. But when it comes to similarities in language similarities for the idea of religion, that what he gave us is more similar to Trinitarianism than it is to Islam, monotheism, or the religion of Jews, you see. And there was a black man, very popular black man, who had already presented himself as God, New Jesus Christ, Father the Grand, Father Divine, he's called. So Farrar didn't have to stretch his mind or strain his mind to come up with something. There was a black man, a Christian, who was already telling his congregation that if you want to see Jesus, look at me. That we were saying. This is documented. Father Divine was telling his congregation, if you want to see Jesus, look at me. So he didn't want his congregation looking at whites, or white image, or European man, or Jew. You know, if you want to see Jesus, look at me, a black man. That's what he said, a black man. So Farrar saw this and liked it, obviously. And he looked at Booker T. Washington, what Booker T. Washington was doing in Tuskegee University, how he was having his students go through military drill, and he believed that it would help discipline them. Farrar adopted it. So Farrar was just a very open-minded and alert man and a very daring, bold thinker who believed that he could formulate something. If he studied the people, he could formulate something that they would have an appetite for. And that's what he did. He formulated something that he thought the black separatists or extremists had an appetite for. And he made the package to appeal to black separatists, black supremacists. People who wanted to feel bigger than white men. And it worked. But he made it temporary. He put in language. If I had done it, believe me, I'd probably be still in following it. Because I would have respected logic and reasoning. But he intentionally had a head-on collision with logic, with common sense. He intentionally did that so that when his following that he attracted from the most uneducated and most deprived, culturally deprived, of Detroit, Michigan, and Chicago, Southside, etc., when that following find better opportunities in America and follow his direction, he said, get education, learn about civilization. He said, become engineers. This is Farrar. He gave us little writings and said, study engineers, study civil engineers, study electrical engineering. This is what he said to us in his own writings. Farrar did, not my father. Yeah. So he knew that if he encouraged us to go in the direction of knowledge and higher education and professions, that eventually we would be too rational and too sensible to accept his irrational basis for our existence in this world. And it worked.
Now, did your father ever directly tell you that he wanted the movement to eventually rejoin the Orthodox Sunni?
No. In fact, he made efforts to protect us against the temptation to join Orthodox Islam, Orthodox Muslims. He told us that his teacher said, be careful of them, because they will misguide you, he said. They will misguide you, and they will deprive you of your blessing that you have coming from Allah. Mm-hmm. Allah intends to give you a special blessing. He said if you be influenced by them, they will deprive you of that special blessing. That's what he told us. And he was correct. Because most of the immigrant Muslims that come over here, they want to be our big brother. Mm-hmm. And in fact, more than that, they want to be our second daddy. Mm-hmm. They saw the white supremacists as our first daddy. Mm-hmm. And they envy what was going on in that relationship. And now they want to become our second daddy.
So how do you
Elijah Muhammad, his teacher was right. His teacher knew their mentality, so he said something to them. And right now, I'm not a Muslim because of me and my mind or my heart embracing the message of Orthodox Islam. I'm a Muslim because of me following my curiosities, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad encouraged me to follow my curiosity, and finding in the Quran the light of this, the light of truth, and finding in Muhammad the beauty of humanity. That's why I'm a Muslim.
Your own personal progression seems to mirror that of your friend Malcolm X, that from the teachings of the old Nation of Islam to Orthodox Sunni Islam.
Yes.
Can you speak a little bit about your own personal ties to Malcolm X, how much of your own philosophy is in congruence with his, and whether there is any difference.
Well, what came from Malcolm was that the correct religion was the religion of the millions of Muslims on this earth, not the Islam that he learned from the Temple of Islam, from the Temple of Islam. So Malcolm and I came to the same conclusion. But I think for Malcolm, that was a relief station, okay? For me, it's not a relief station. Mm-hmm. It's a call to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
It's a path of God. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. For Malcolm, it was a relief station. Here I'm relieved. I don't have to worry about Yaqub's history anymore, mm-hmm. that I could never digest mentally. Mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about only Elijah Muhammad as being our leader anymore. I can reject him now. He, the prophet of Islam, is all of our leader, you know? So that was a relief station. Now that I'm relieved, now let me get my agenda together. And he got his agenda together. His was to appeal to the United Nations for relief for black people, not to trust America, but to go to the United Nations and make his appeal there to get them to see that this is not a civil rights issue, this is a human rights issue, and the United Nations are going to take this case, okay? His interest was in Africa, the militant leaders of Africa. His pride was Africa's glory, you see, and my pride was faith in God, and it still is. So don't think because we both say Islam is correct and the old teachings are wrong that we were together. We were not together.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think if he was living now, I don't think we'd be together. I think he'd be more political than I am. And he would be less community-oriented than I am. I'm community-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
He would be politically oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And whether he was true in saying that he was not racist anymore, I think he would still be called racist because he would still be championed the black man's case and his complaints, the complaints and case of the black man. I can champion the case, but I can't handle those complaints.
Too many ridiculous complaints
that seem to keep us in our situation. Yes, I believe the way to come out of our situation is the way that Elijah Muhammad was. Elijah Muhammad was right that you have to stop blaming others for your situation and you have to blame yourself for your situation and do something about your own situation. So Elijah Muhammad was correct there. But I think Malcolm is a political man, so the politician always take up the issue.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't look at it, see if it's rational or not. But, hey, my people says this is hurting.
Now, on the issue of politics as well, it's somewhat of a departure in that you've lifted the ban on voting and ban on public life. And for a time, you were thinking even of running for president yourself.
Well,
is that a possibility at any?
No. I said that just to make our people more conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Of the freedom that we have in this country,
mm-hmm.
to pursue even the presidency, if we have what it takes,
mm-hmm.
to become president.
Right? Mm-hmm.
I said in hope that more of us would take that seriously, and in the mm-hmm. future we have more candidates from the African American people seeking to be the leader of this great nation.
Do you see any prospects out there? You know, people talk about General Powell. People talk about Jesse Jackson.
Yes, General Powell.
Mm-hmm.
General Powell is a man that I think would make a good second or a good first for the United States,
mm-hmm.
Vice President or President. Right?
Mm-hmm. Who else might be good people to watch?
I haven't found him yet.
What about Jesse Jackson? There is some static back in the, I believe it was 84. Is that all in the past?
Well, I never took him seriously
mm-hmm.
when he was talking about running for president. I never took him seriously. I thought he was trying to do just what I was trying to do, just get it on the mind of more of those who perhaps will be qualified.
Actually, that was the fruit when I was just starting out in journalism.
He got too much wind in his mouth to be president of the United States.
But do you think he has moved beyond that? Do you think that it's...
He possibly can move beyond that. But I don't know if he'll move beyond that yet.
About the same time that was happening, in one of your publications, you said that Ronald Reagan had been, had on the whole, been done more good than bad.
Yes.
Do you still...
I meant for our situation, for the African-American situation.
Right. Do you,
yes. I think the Democrats were doing everything to keep us with the Democratic Party. But was not in a situation because of that, because of being more interested in us remaining Democrats than anything else, they were not looking at what's best for our condition, what's best for our sensitivities, you know. So they, in my opinion, they fed those sensitivities of the blacks that have weakened us instead of strengthened us as a people. And that's the awareness that we have been mistreated and held back and don't have jobs, you know, and need to be have more opportunities and to be made equal. So to me, they increased the volume of our song of lamenting, our lamenting hymns, you know, and that's not good for us. The slaves, when they were free, we learned from the study of the effect of proclamation, freeing us, that those slaves, they were celebrating and cheering, and say many were seen in the fields with their plows still in their hands, leaning on their plow. And some were seen with a piece of printed material, trying to read it. And that's what they thought freedom meant. Now we can learn to read. Now we can go to schools. We can become educated. So that's what freedom meant to them. And now we can have a part in the world of the white man. We can have a place in a part of the world of the white man. A part means we can have our businesses, we can have citizenship, we can have businesses. So that's what freedom meant to them. And I think the Democrats didn't keep to that original spirit of the black people, but followed the politicians of the black politicians, who have been nothing but leaders who register complaints and then carry them to the white man. They don't examine complaints, they just register complaints. They take complaints. So the Democratic Party, I think, became the second church. And whoever the president, he became the second Christ for black Christians.
Often there's been...
And I mean that. I mean that. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Put too much faith in the white, the president of the United States. If you get a good president of the United States, we're going to be all right.
So it seems there's often a congruence between between African-American leaders who are tired of dependency and Republican leaders who seem to have their own agenda that may really not be all that sympathetic to African-Americans. Is this sort of coming together of unlikely allies, is it more of a reflection on the moral bankruptcy of the Democrats than on any real tie to the Republicans, or is there or is that an unduly cynical outlook? I mean, do you consider yourself a Republican, or do you just consider...
I can't make a decision. And I'm liked a lot by conservative Republicans. And they send me some very interesting invitations, you know. Very attractive individuals to join them, but I haven't been able to myself make up my mind to be a Republican or a Democrat. I like something in both. And I think I can be a Democrat and yet be the conservative person I am. I don't think I have to be on the extreme left to be a good Democrat. So I'm hoping that Colin Powell will one day decide to run for president, or at least to be the partner of someone running for president, you know, vice president. And I'm hoping that he will remain the Democrat. Well, he'll be Democrat, not Republican. Because I think there's less, I would say, attention from Democrats on how Democratic you are than there is attention from Republicans on you, how Republican you are. So I think a Democrat is kind of loose thing. You can be conservative and yet a Democrat, and be respected and loved by Democrats, depending on the season, what time it is. And I think the season now, the time is for conservatism.
I assume a lot of that, though, is a moral conservatism.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Right. So do you see a danger, though, in that in when one puts forward a message of self-reliance, which is a strong, self-motivated message, I think, that can work well with any political program, that it, do you see a danger of the Republicans taking that aspect of it? The, yes, be self-reliant. We don't take anything from us, without taking the other side, which is we're self-reliant, but we demand our rights. Do you see a danger of the Republicans using only one side of the equation without
the
other?
Yes, I do. And but at the same time, I'm aware that many African Americans are becoming much more sober-minded in politics now, much more rational. When I say sober, not given to extremes, right, the extremes left anymore. They realize that the new world that we're seeing, where we have to share with other people, one nation can't just grow and grow and grow heavy while other people are starving and being deprived. So they are African Americans are now who have an interest in politics, they're recognizing that. So the Republican Party will be getting more African Americans over to their side. I do believe that. And really, I'm one that's close to going to their side. But I can't go to their side because I think there's more opportunity for conservative African Americans. Yes, I think I can't go to the Republican side because I believe there are more opportunities for conservative statements in the African American community to better our condition of our people, the black community life, the neighborhood life of black Americans, by remaining Democrats than by becoming Republicans. And it's because, I repeat, that Democrats are not looking too closely at how far to the left you are. They just don't want you to become Republican.
In an interview back in, I think it was the late 80s, you had you'd said that now African Americans can rely on the courts to defend their rights. That was a statement that you made before Rodney King. In the wake of the Rodney King trial, when many African Americans and many Americans of all backgrounds felt that the courts did not do a sufficient job of punishing those guilty of mistreating African Americans, do you still have the same faith that African Americans can simply count on the courts to do the right thing?
Yes. Yes, I do. And even more so now. You know, innocence or belief that we should do the right thing. There are always a number of people in every community, white, black, Indian, Arab, whoever, who are going to stay with that. They're going to stay with that belief that we should do the right thing. But as conditions change for life and opportunities, you will find people changing too. Many will change too. Not that innocent group, but many others who look at circumstances and want to get ahead in the world, they'll start changing with the weather. I believe that conditions for us are better now than they were before Rodney King. The conditions are improving for the government being more trustworthy when it comes to black interests, our interests of blacks and our betterment here in America, and the betterment of the African American people. Has become better because of the growing number of non-whites we have in this society. It's increasing. People are migrating here, and the land is changing, as Ebony said in one of its yearly issues, coloring of America, or something like that, I think the headline said, the coloring of America. And as the President Clinton is saying, and when he's meeting with the clergy, that America is becoming a place of different races, different nationalities, whereas it used to be mostly a white country, the country of the white people. Now it's our black and white is changing from black and white to being a colorful nation of many different colors of people. So because of this change, our government too is situated better to defend the rights of all citizens, because the government is not looking at white and black anymore. But this change also means that black has to firm up and become more adult. Because if you just come with the same milk, asking for the same milk bottle to be put in your mouth with the nipple on it, and crying like a baby who needs a diaper change, you're not going to get any response from this new government that's looking at these new people. Many of them industrious, and they want to start from scratch. They come from poverty, and they want to build their life in America. So the government, looking at all of these different groups now, will look and say, well, we still got a small baby here, and something has to do something to correct this thing here. So blacks have a better situation with the government now for us to realize freedom and opportunities in this great country. But also we should realize, too, that these other citizens who are competing for progress in this great society, the government is looking at them, too. And if we don't firm up and become a little more rugged than we have been, that we are going to be ignored more and more.
Now, most of my readers will be very surprised to find that the majority of black Muslims in America follow you rather than Minister Farrakhan. Can you speak a little bit about the areas in which you and Minister Farrakhan have the same ideas and areas in which you have disagreements?
Okay, we have the same idea for improvement of the, I would say, the mind of African American people. Farrakhan believes that we need change in the way we think. And I believe, too, that we need serious changes in the way we think. We should normalize our thinking as a social group or as a racial group. And normalize our thinking means that we should not look outside for help that's inside. We should first turn to help that's inside and then to help that's outside when we don't have any more help coming from the inside. We should only go and ask other people to help us when we've done everything we could to help ourselves. That's the teaching of the Imam Elijah Muhammad. And that's Farrakhan's position, that's my position. But I think, except for that, because even the Farrakhan, he wants to help the youngsters, you know. He wants our young men to take charge of their lives and be responsible for their neighborhoods and for their families, to be responsible for the family and etc. He wants that, but he wants it in the name of black pride. And I think in the long run, you lose that energy. It'll fail others, everybody, not just black. It'll fail any people. If they do something in the name of their color or their race, in the long run, it's going to fail them. Their energy is going to fail them. It's going to die out. So I don't see myself agreeing with Farrakhan or joining him in any program to help our youth. But I think the way to help our youth is to connect them back with their human energy, with their progressive human energy. Yes, the human being that says, I'm never as good as I should be. I'm never as perfect as I should be. I'm never as charitable as I should be, but always looking for more room and more room to do good and to contribute to the betterment of society. So we, if Farrakhan was situated in humanity and faith in God, then I could walk a long ways with Farrakhan. In fact, I would tell him, why don't we join each other? And why don't you, since you are electrifying speaker, why don't you be our politician? Or why don't you head up this human service effort here, you know, community service effort here, partly. Why don't you head up this community service here? You can attract the people. You're powerful. You have the magnetism and everything, you know. But he's not in the right condition. And I think he's troubled. I think he's troubled. So I think denial of freedom to the human spirit is something that affects the soul and stays with the soul. So I think Farrakhan is now a man that's having two spirits in him, and they war with each other. One is the spirit to reclaim his humanity, and the other one is a spirit to stay popular.
Do you see his vision of Islam as really being Islam?
No, his vision of Islam is not existing. He has to have a new condition in himself. He has to come into a new frame of mind in order to see Islam. He can't see Islam.
So would you say he's not really a Muslim?
No, he's not a Muslim. How can he be a Muslim when he doesn't follow the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him? Yeah. He follows his own mind. He follows his own thinking.
What specific teachings would he have to give up to be a true Muslim in your view?
He would have to give up the religion that he got from all of the right Prophet. That's what he has to give up.
And do you think there's any chance of that happening?
I pray for it. I hope mm-hmm. for it. I pray for it. Mm-hmm. But I don't expect it. Because all that we've done, you know, we've had met with him, and we've talked with him. The Rabita met with him, based in Saudi Arabia, World Muslim League, met with him. Leading thinkers in Islam from around the world have met with him. And sometimes he seems to be in perfect agreement with the right way, but when he goes back to do his work doesn't change. His work is the same almost, you know.
What?
There's hope for his people, and I think that hope for his people is owing somewhat to Farrakhan being a very intelligent man. He's not stupid. Farrakhan is an intelligent man. He's an educated man too. I'm not formally educated that much, you know. So I think a lot of the better opportunities, the better chances now that exist for followers of Farrakhan to come into real Islam is owing to Farrakhan being an intelligent and educated man. So he knows that he has to not completely separate from the Muslim world, because there's opportunities for him to gain materially from claiming he is with the Muslim world. From Gaddafi, you know, he's Gaddafi. He's a unique creation. But Gaddafi is a Muslim, and Gaddafi is for Islam. So if Farrakhan keeps coming to Gaddafi for money or for assistance, financial assistance, Gaddafi is going to continue to hold that money out as a carrot to get Farrakhan to become more Islamic. And Farrakhan knows that. I understand that he went to Mecca on his world tour. So he knows if he goes there, he's going to have to pretend that he has an interest in one day bringing his people in line with Islam. So that helps. He has to come back home and he has to tell his people, well, we need Arabic classes and we need to learn how to say our prayers correctly. And that. So that's good. Farrakhan is helping his followers to become acquainted with Islam, with real Islam, because of his interest in gaining financial help from Islamic countries.
You've made a very good point around the time of the Gulf War, though, in distinguishing between real Islam and simply political leaders, possibly in the Arab world, possibly anywhere in the world, who use Islam for their political ends. Just as, say, Saddam Hussein, who you were very clearly against in the Gulf War, when it served his interest, he put himself forward as the champion of secularism against Islam in Iran. And then when it served his image, he went back and said he was for Islam.
That's right.
Do you see this going on as well throughout the world, of leaders in various countries simply using Islam for their own political ends?
Yes, I meet with what we call scholars of Islam, members of the ulema, the scholars of Islam, and with some pious imam. And I find that both the intellectual-minded Muslim leaders and the spiritual-minded Muslim leaders are saying the same thing about the condition of Islamic nations. And they are saying that there is no Islamic nation. That's what they say. There is no Islamic nation. We have Muslims, but no Islamic nation. And they're saying it's because these leaders, they are following a nationalist tradition and not an Islamic tradition. The Egyptian, he has his attachment to Egypt interests. And the other national leader will have his attachment to his nation's national interest, and he will be playing on the national interest sensitivities in the subjects in his constituents, rather than playing on their Islamic sensitivities on Islamic interests. So they are saying that we can't expect Islamic nations to go anywhere with Islam until they come back to Islam and see God first and faith first, and then serve a faith community. Yes. So I agree with them that that's the condition of the world. That's the condition of the Islamic world. That these leaders have been responding to I would say the superiority of the West and the domination of the West, as what they see as the domination of the West. They have been responding to that, or reacting to that, more than planning the future for a faith community. Muslims are a faith community. So instead of planning and helping the faith community overcome its setback, because we've been set back, they come into power and then they become demagogues. They play on the emotional buttons of the members in their constituents.
I've just returned from Indonesia, where I was fortunate enough to meet Abdul Rahman Wahid and Amian Rais, two Muslim leaders who between them have something like 70 million followers. Both of them put forward a vision of Islam that is very, very much in congruence with your own. A very tolerant, open-minded, open view of Islam. Why do you feel it is that on the world stage, Western people tend to take, say, the Taliban or Ayatollah Khomeini as the voice of Islam rather than people like Abdul Rahman Wahid? And on the domestic scene, they tend to look at Louis Farrakhan as the voice of American Islam rather than someone like you who has a much larger following. Could you speak a little bit about that phenomenon of the public sort of seeking out the most extreme leaders rather than the most representative leaders?
Yeah. Well, I think We have some very good leaders, very sincere leaders, but our leaders, I believe that our leaders are not looking at what is happening outside of our awareness. They're looking at what is happening inside of our awareness. So they're not going to address those two great individuals that you mentioned, that you met in Indonesia. They're not interested in them because they're not inside our awareness. But Farrakhan is, Gaddafi is, the Taliban is, you see? So that's what they're going to address. Mm-hmm. I think that's the answer, you know. The other part of the answer is, I'm speaking of our leaders now, in the political scene. But the other part of the answer is that these people are not yet popular, so they're not going to sell newspapers. They're not going to raise the, break up the ratings, TV ratings. So why be bothered with them? Yeah. So what they need to do, they need to create a disturbance so somebody will know it.
What I'm hoping to do with this article, since it's slated to be a cover and it's an opportunity to, I hope, really get the message out for the leaders who are one of your followers in Washington, referred to you as a quiet storm, making a disturbance but making it quiet without, you know. What are the misconceptions about Islam here in America or around the world? What are the things that you wish the media would say but that it hasn't been saying? Your opportunity, open question as kind of a closing question, open table for you. For what message would you like to get out to the American people that hasn't gotten out enough?
That Muslims are human beings and our religion has contributed to the same fine human sensitivities that are appreciated by Christians, Jews, and all the people that America accepts as being good neighbors, you see? So I would like for them to see us as good neighbors, and that a Muslim who's true to his religion is a good neighbor. And a Muslim who's true to his religion believes very, very, very nearly the same way that Christian believes as a religious person. And we are natural allies, not natural enemies. Any true Muslim and true Christian, when you look at what we say we believe in, the articles of faith for us, you will see that we should be natural, spiritual allies, not natural enemies. And they should realize that the Crusades took Islam off course, took Muslims off course, and took Christians off course. And we're all trying to recover.
Well, Imam, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me. I'm sure my readers will be enlightened by what you've told me, and I know I certainly have been.
Well, thank you.
Thank you
very much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
And I'm going to get some more prescriptions for my friends.
For more on the ministry of Imam W. Dean Muhammad, Muslim American spokesman, call 1-708-201-9692. All right, Ministry of W. Dean Muhammad, Post Office Box 1061, Calumet City, Illinois, 60409. For Muslim Journal, see local distributor. For WDM Publications, call 1-708-862-7733. All right, Post Office Box 1944, Calumet City, Illinois, 60409. And thanks for listening.